Hello. Buenas noches, amigos, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this Friday 13. Friday is dedicated to Venus, and I would say that it is associated with Freya, with this mythological goddess, and the 13 moons. So, in the Brendalismus activities, last month, we were studying Liz Green, Jung's studies in astrology, prophecy, magic, and the qualities of time. And we continue tonight with Liz Green and Jung's studies in astrology. We're going to dive into the chapter of great faith. Man's character is his fate, Heraclitus. Fate and soul are but two names for the same principle, Novalis. The ancients devised the magic to compel fate. They needed it to determine outer fate. We needed to determine inner fate and to find the way that we are unable to conceive. Jung. Arose by any other name. Like the roads that lead to Rome, any discussion of Jung's astrology leads sooner or later to the question of how he understood fate. Astrology and philosophical speculations about fate have been cohabiting intimately since the origins of both. A number of modern astrological texts have addressed in more contemporary languages the question of whether an individual's fate is described by the horoscope. Sometimes other words with different nuance are used, such as destiny. Many astrologers in the second half of the 20th century begin to reject the idea of fated circumstances altogether and refer it to trends rather than the ancient idea of heimarmene, the compulsion of the stars. An example of this modernizing of astral fate was offered by the British astrologer Geoff Mayo, who declare categorically, an astrological aspect with regard to the future can correspond with any one of a variety of possibilities, mostly dependent upon the freedom of choice, the choice of the individual concerned. Yet the aspect still foretells the actual trend of circumstances or the nature of the individual reaction to the situation. Other astrologers accepted the idea of astral fate in principle, but suggested that it involves only the physical circumstances of the individual and not the soul. This quasi-Platonic, quasi-Gnostic approach was expressed by the British astrologer Margaret Horne in 1951. Inasmuch as a man human identifies himself with his physical self and the physical world about him, so he is indissolubly part of it and subject to its changing patterns as formed by the planets in their orbit. Only by the recognition of that which he senses as greater than himself can he attune himself to what is beyond the terrestrial pattern. In this way, though, he may not escape terrestrial happenings by the doctrine of free and willing acceptance. He can will that his real self is free in its reactions to them. This perspective allows a form of freedom as well as an acknowledgement of fate, but it reflects a dualism of spirit and matter that was alien to Jung's own view of their unity. In antiquity, the ways in which astral fate was understood varied among different philosophical and religious systems. Certain Hermetic fragments claim that astral fate acts upon the body or on the lower dimensions of the soul, but the higher soul or nous remains free from its influence. We have the power to choose. It is between our power to choose the better and in like way to choose the worse according to our will. And if our choice clings to the evil things, it doth consort with the corporeal nature, and for this cause fate rules over him whom makes this choice. Since then, the intellectual sense in us is absolutely free. On this account, fate does not reach it. This is the view echoed by astrologer Margaret Hone in the mid-20th century. Certain Gnostic treatises, such as the Apocryphon of John, present the idea that each planetary archon places a kind of psychic membrane over the human soul, and as it descends into incarnation, resulting in a soul vehicle of seven layers, each under the governance of one of the seven archons. These layers collectively called the counterfeit spirits were perceived as malign, reflecting the idea that the planetary archons blind the soul to matter through libidinous compulsions and obstruct the soul's recollection of its divine source. Between early Christian contexts, the idea of Ermarmen remained an important theme in theological discourse, but astral fate was viewed as powerless against those who had undergone Christian baptism. In the medieval period, largely due to the teaching of Dominican priest and Aristotelian philosopher Thomas Aquino, the dualist approach presented in Hermetic and Gnostic treatises resurfaced as an acceptable Christian concept. A fate dictated by the stars was understood to pertain to physical desires and needs. Since the body belonged to the corruptible sublunar realm in the context of Aristotelian cosmology, but the soul belonged to God and was beyond the reach of astral influences. Modern philosophers have come to no more inclusive agreements than their ancient predecessors. The term fate has been replaced by determinism, a word less prone to religious associations and adaptable to economic, climatic, social, and political rather than astral powers. Astrology has naturally been dropped from these modern philosophical discourses, but Jung remained profoundly concerned with the problem of fate in relation to the heavenly bodies. He looked to Kant, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche for philosophical illumination, but he turned to the Neoplatonist, Stoics, Hermeticism, and Gnostics for more practical insight into the dilemma, not least because in these older currents, astral fate lies at the center of the discourse. Modern psychologists and psychiatrists are also concerned with the question of fate. However, in cognitive and behavioral schools of psychology, as in philosophy, astrological discourse has largely vanished, and fate is usually called by other names. In the field of organic psychiatry, it is increasingly enmeshed with the study of genetics and is now referred as genetic fate mapping, nature, nurture, and reincarnation. The role of causality in human psychic suffering invariably leads back to the mystery surrounding fate. Whatever synonyms might be adopted to replace the word. For example, are people born inherently bad, genetically programmed and thus fated to do bad deeds? Or do they become bad and thus equally fate through the pressure of external circumstance did they not choose? And if is the latter, do they have any choice later on? Or given the right social and clinical resources, the possibility of healing? The two general approaches have arisen, which form the backbone of the so-called nature-nature debate in modern psychologies. The first conclusion, rooted in the theory of classical conditioning, developed by Russian psychologist Ivan Petrovich Pavlov in the early 20th century, embraces a perception of the human being as a tabula rasa, a blank state influenced entirely by environmental conditioning. Psychotherapeutic approaches based on this view are now known under the general umbrella of behavioral therapies. The second conclusion, also causal, is based on a purely biological view in which the chemistry of the brain determines the psychophysical future of the individual. A middle way between these two extremes may also be adopted, in which psychology, nature, and environmental nurture are both implicated in varying degrees in the formation of personality. In his early psychiatric works, it seems that Jung attempted this kind of compromise, declaring, "The endless dilemma of culture and nature is always a question of too much or too little, never of either or." By the time he began work on Liber Novus, however, Jung seems to have adopted a third approach. It was favored in late antiquity, but is unpopular today between the fields of medicine and organic psychiatry because it is acausal and restrained to demonstrations through scientific methodologies. This approach involves a perception of the fate of the human being as embodying an a priori inherent character, self or soul constellation that mysteriously expresses itself through the outer circumstances of an individual fate. The source and nature of this inherent essence remains hidden, hinting at a more intuitive mode of speculation, or at the very last, the admission that proving its existence is impossible between current research paradigms. The idea of inherent temperament, independent of but complementing both genetic inheritance and environment, suggests a meaningful theology of inner development rather than static bondage to preordained circumstances. It may also be accompanied by the understanding that the intent of this essence, personified by the daimon, is reflected in the qualities of time described by the patterns of the natal horoscope. This approach eventually seems to have dominated Jung's thinking on fate. In antiquity, the idea was usually accompanied by belief in successive incarnations of the soul, each human lifetime, its individuation, daimon, and its specific fate are shaped by the choices made in the previous lifetime. The greater the individual's awareness of these facts, the more he or she is able to make conscious choices and develop creatively within the limits of that which cannot be changed. This results in greater harmony between the individual and the intent of the daimon. The idea of a series of incarnation in which the karma or psychic substance accrued in a given lifetime generates the challenges and rewards of the next lifetime. He has had a very long life in Western esoteric currents, resurrected by modern times by the Madame Blavatsky and her followers through assimilating Hindu and Buddhism through two Platonic and Neoplatonic concepts and lacing both with a distinctively Christian morality. Alan Liu, who embraced the idea wholeheartedly and incorporated it into his astrological writings, insisted that astrology has no permanent value without incorporating the reality of former lives. That Jung was receptive to the idea of reincarnation in later life and possibly earlier is indicated by the statement in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Somewhere out there, there must be a determinant and necessity condition in the world. This creative determinant must decide what souls will plunge again into birth. It is possible that any further spell of three-dimensional life will have no more meaning once the soul had reached a certain stage of understanding it. It will then no longer have to return. But if karma still remains to be disposed of, then the soul relapses again into desires and returns to life once more, perhaps even doing so out of the realization that something remains to be completed. Jung also speculated on what remains to be completed in his own life. It must have been a passionate urge towards understanding which brought about my birth. I could well imagine that I may have lived in former centuries and there encountered questions I was not yet able to answer, that I had to be born again because I had not fulfilled the task that it was given to me. Jung referred to reincarnation in the context of Eastern concepts of karma, and he also recognized its importance in Platonic and Neoplatonic literature. Moreover, he was fully aware that modern theosophical speculations borrowed from both. The link between the natal horoscope and the cycle of rebirth was described explicitly by Annie Besant, who became president of the Theosophical Society in 1907. The karma of past lives, mental, emotional, and in relation to others, demands materials capable of the most varied expressions. According to this temperament, will be the time of the birth of the body. It must be born into the world at a time when the physical planetary influences are suitable, and it thus is born under its astrological star. It is not the star that imposes the temperament, but the temperament that fixes the epoch of birth under the star. Jung insisted that the idea of rebirth is inseparable from that of karma. He repeatedly encountered in Alan Liu's books the conviction that rebirth and karma are themselves inseparable from the moment of physical birth and the horoscope based on it. Also, Jung did not relate rebirth and karma to astrology in any published work. It seems to have underpinned much of his understanding of his own horoscope, particularly in terms of what he viewed as what remains to be completed. Fate and individuation. Jung embraced the older, a causal view of fate during or soon after his break with Freud. In Psychology of the Unconscious, he indulged in one of his favorite pastimes, etymological associations. In this case, connecting the Greek word of fate, moira, with various words related to the Indo-European root mer or mor, meaning to die, he related these words in turn to the Roman divine mothers, the matres or matronae, who are both the Teutonic Norns and the Greek Moirai. This kind of imaginative association of words, word roots and symbols is an aspect of Jung's thought that can be challenging to those who think of language as a purely semantic, culturally constructed instrument of communication. But whatever or not Jung's analogical digressions comprise a scientific method, by the time he began work on Liber Novus, he had already made the equation between faith and soul. This may reflect the influence of German Romantic writers such as Novalis. It may also reflect Jung's studies of astrology, especially the kind of astrology presented by Adam Leo, which led him to what he perceived as a clear demonstration of a priori existence of a character structured, mirrored by or synchronous with the natal horoscope. The inseparable intertwining of faith and character was presented by Leo in a work titled Saturn the Reaper, which Jung seems to have acquired soon after its publication in 1916. In the foreword to this work, Leo declared, "Character is destiny. For Jung, the qualities of time itself, reflected in astrological symbols, constitute astral fate, since time, as Jung declared, is often the symbol of fate. The moment of birth is thus a kind of snapshot, incarnated in flesh, of those typical qualities of the libido at a given moment." Jung's deep and ongoing concerns with the nature of fate may be expected in someone whose work was dedicated to understanding and healing psychic suffering. There are many references to the conundrum of fate and free will in the collected works, as well as in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and Dream Analysis. In 1912, a year before he began work on Liber Novus, Jung identified fate with the archetypes. The effect of the unconscious images has something fateful about it. Perhaps, who knows, these eternal images are what the human mean by fate. In Psychology of the Unconscious, Jung called fate the driving force of the libido. The power of fate makes itself felt unpleasantly only when everything goes against our will. That is to say, when we no longer find ourselves in harmony with ourselves, the power of fate reveals itself at closer range as a compulsion of the libido. This observation is a profoundly interior perception of fate, expressed not in terms of external events, but as those inner compulsions that thwart every good intention of consciousness and result in unconscious choices which entangle the individual in painful external circumstances that have no easy resolution. Astral fate is described in this manner in a number of Gnostic and Hermetic texts, which Jung believed provided him with the historical counterpart of My Psychology of the Unconscious. In an essay titled Psychology and Religion, first given as a series of lectures in 1937, Jung expressed succinctly his conviction that the individual's experience of free will is severely limited by the principalities of powers of the unconscious psyche. Each of us is equipped with the psychic disposition that limits our freedom in high degree and make it particularly illusory. We do not enjoy masterless freedom. We are continually threatened by psychic factors which, in the guise of natural phenomena, may take possession of us at any moment. Principalities and powers are always between us. We have no need to create them, even if we will, if we could. Much later in his life, in an interview given to the Daily Mail, Jung expressed his understanding of the unity of faith and psyche, echoing Novalis' declaration that faith and soul are but two names for the same principle, by stating, "What happens to a person is characteristic of him. He represents a pattern, and all the pieces fit one by one. In his life proceeds, they fall into place according to some predestined sign, design. Faith and soul, as presented in Liber Novus, are indeed two different names for a single principle." Addressing his soul, Jung declared, "You took away where I thought to take hold, and you gave me where I did not expect anything, and time and again, you brought about faith from new and unexpected quarters." Jung also equated faith with the self, the goal of the individuation process, because it is the most complete expression of that faithful combination we call individuality. What happens to any individual, excluding those experiences that are part of the fate of the peoples and can subsume individual unfoldment, is therefore a reflection of this mysterious inner process, which can only be transformed, although neither avoided nor eradicated, through consciousness. If we do not see a thing, Jung commented in one of his ETH lectures, "Fate does it to us." The Stoic Ermarmanea. Jung seems to have adopted some of his ideas about fate from the Stoics, in particular the concept of Hermarmenia, which he described as the compulsion of the stars. He also defined Hermarmenia as the dependence of character and destiny on certain moments in time. The term destiny is subtly different from the idea of fate, as either karmic retribution or pathological compulsion, and suggests something more akin to Neoplatonic ideas of the teleological